From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. And this morning we speak with journalist and author Christy Ashwandan, who talks about MHO, or metabolically healthy obesity, in her recent Scientific American article, People Who Are Fat and Healthy May Hold Keys to Understanding Obesity.
Such an interesting conversation. Yeah. And then in our ongoing series on print publications in the outdoor and mountain town space, we speak with veteran publisher Paul Ulrich, who is the editor of two magazines, Ascent and the forthcoming Van Life Adventure Journal. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
So there's this acronym, MHO, which means metabolically healthy obesity. So someone who might qualify as obese when their BMI, or body mass index, is measured. But healthy in this case means someone who is considered obese but doesn't have any of those regular markers. They don't have high blood pressure or high cholesterol levels. They don't have insulin sensitivity, triglyceride counts, or high liver fat levels. So what's behind this discussion? We've long been taught that obesity leads to heightened health risks. Well, joining us now to explain it all is science journalist and author Christy Ashwandan. She's written an article in the recent issue of Scientific American titled, People Who Are Fat and Healthy May Hold Keys to Understanding Obesity. Christy Ashwandan, welcome back to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thank you so much for having me.
I bet you found this really interesting. I know you, as a person who's been a longtime endurance athlete, to uncover this whole thing about these discrepancies with body mass index and being healthy. How did you first come across it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Actually, my editor at Scientific American said I wrote a big feature for Scientific American about the title was The Rise and Fall of Vitamin D, about how vitamin D, you used to think it's, you know, cured everything. And now we're realizing that actually most people don't need supplements, and people that are told they're deficient probably aren't. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But that was a pretty research intensive story. And he said, you know, I have something else I'd like you to look into. So I didn't know that much about this topic when I started reporting. And then I got into it, and it was just fascinating. And, you know, I think it's really something that hits on so many things that our culture really, you know, whether you are thin or fat, weight is something that we're all aware of. There's so much stigma around it. It's really, and we're at this cultural moment now with these new obesity drugs where things are really changing. And I think it really brings a lot of these issues to the forefront.
Yes. And in this recent issue of Scientific American, there are several articles kind of around this topic.
Right.
We're talking about Ozempic. We're talking about how these weight loss drugs are really revolutionizing how we look at weight, how we look at health. There's something about body mass index, though, and I've heard other people talk about the BMI being kind of faulty somehow. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. In fact, it is so problematic that the American Medical Association pretty recently actually put out sort of a statement saying that, you know, we need to be careful, that BMI is not a good marker of health, and that, you know, basically trying to push back against the misuse. Because as you said, BMI is a very imperfect measure of obesity. And I think here we need to take a step back. And part of the issue here is that, you know, we're looking at what is it that's actually harmful to health here. You know, it's not your absolute weight. It's really about excess fat, and not just excess fat. It's really a lot about where that excess fat is stored, what sort of metabolic problems it may be causing. And that's not universal at a certain, you know, even a certain, you can weigh the actual fat, right? And it could vary from person to person. And so there's an individual aspect to this, but BMI is really just a measure of height versus weight. And so it's a very, very crude measure of obesity. And there's pretty widespread agreement in the medical community, even, that this is not an ideal way to diagnose obesity. The problem is that we don't really have anything better. There have been some other things proposed. So hip to waist ratio seems to be superior to BMI in most cases in terms of looking for excess fat that might have these metabolic issues or metabolic problems. But that's a tricky one, and it's still not perfect. Actually looking at body composition, which is more what we're interested in, right? Like how much fat someone has versus lean body weight. That may be better, but again, that doesn't capture where it's stored, which seems to be important. So it's interesting because the kind of fat storage that people really try to avoid, you know, you don't want to have fat on your hips and your butt and all these other places. That's actually sort of the healthiest place to store it. So subcutaneous fat seems to be less harmful to your health than fat that's stored internally around the organs. And that is why, you know, having a larger waist seems to be a greater risk than, say, carrying excess fat on the hips or buttocks or legs and things like that. So that's kind of interesting. And we're still really in early days in terms of understanding the metabolic stuff that's going on here and understanding how that impacts health and impacts metabolic health.
What would you say are some of the biggest myths that you discovered when you were working on this of people's associations with obesity and poor health?
I think one myth is just, you know, we really have a terrible problem in this country, and probably not just this country. So the stigmatization of larger bodied people. And I think we have to be really careful here. And again, you know, people, there are a lot of different body types that people have. And just because someone's larger doesn't mean that they're having health problems associated with that greater size. And so I think it's really important to, and this also very much goes to healthcare providers, to not be stigmatizing and not making assumptions. I mean, this condition that I wrote about, metabolically healthy obesity or MHO, they're finding that there are people that are extremely fat, you know, have very high BMIs, they're carrying a lot of excess body fat, and yet they don't have these metabolic problems. And so it's really, you know, not correct to call them unhealthy. You know, and there's this controversy of, well, you know, they're going to eventually develop these problems and diabetes and things, but, you know, as long as they don't have it, you can't say that they're not healthy. And so I think it's really forcing researchers and doctors to rethink how they consider this. And I think what it's really showing is that the relationship between body weight and body fat and health is far more complex and nuanced than we'd like to think or that we've been told. And so I think we really need to pull away from this assumption that because someone is larger bodied or even has higher body fat, that they're necessarily unhealthy. Now, that said, there is a very large and robust body of evidence showing that these health problems, and we're talking here about things like diabetes, heart disease, cardiovascular disease. There's also some things that are not metabolic problems. So, for instance, arthritis can be much more problematic. You know, losing weight is a really good way for many people to improve some of their arthritic symptoms, sleep apnea. There are some other things that are caused are linked to higher body weight. But I think we need to be really careful about the stigmatization and this idea that just because someone's larger, that they're inherently unhealthy. And you know, for the story, I talked to some people, a physician who really specializes in treating larger bodied people, who really said, you know, we don't need to talk about weight. Let's talk about the issues that are really happening. Let's talk about someone's blood pressure. What can we do to decrease it if necessary? Let's talk about, are they exercising? Let's talk about diet. Let's talk about these things. But I think, you know, there's a pretty good body of evidence showing that stigmatization of larger body people is just as harmful. You know, so it's a little bit of a balance here too. We also have decades and decades of research showing that it's very, very hard for people to lose weight. It's even harder for them to keep it off. You know, these new obesity drugs may change that, but the problem remains. You know, they're not available to everyone. They're very expensive. I think it can really increase problems of equity. So I think, you know, there's going to be people who are going to be living in larger bodies, and we need to, you know, help them feel healthy and safe and comfortable in those bodies. And healthcare providers need to treat them, you know, with kindness and to acknowledge that and not to stigmatize and, you know, sort of treat the larger body as if it's inherently unhealthy. And I think that, you know, we're really seeing that can be just as harmful, because you have people who are avoiding healthcare because they don't want to be stigmatized by their doctors. And this is a very well-documented problem that's out there.
Yeah. And I think it's been proved psychologically too, that shame is not the best motivator.
Right.
we could really do better with different formats. So mm-hmm. Is there kind of a sweet spot or a safe zone that even people who would show up as obese on the charts, that you find this is an area where typically you're going to find the metabolically healthy people, and then past this point, you might find more issues? Or is it just across the whole board?
Well, definitely, you know, people who have extremely high BMIs or very high body fat, body weight, you know, they're going to be at more risk. So if you're just a little, you know, just barely in the obese category, your chances of having issues are going to be less. It's interesting. There's actually, and this is data that's been replicated again and again, being overweight. So in the overweight, which is not obese, but it's about BMI of 25 to just under 30. Actually, people in this category have lower mortality rates than people in the quote unquote normal. And I don't like using the word normal, because, you know, obviously we all exist on this continuum. But yeah, you know, people who would qualify as non-obese or non-overweight. And so, you know, I think one of the messages here is that being a little bit overweight is not so bad for you necessarily, and particularly as you age. And this is something that I found really interesting. And that is, as you get older, your body composition tends to change. This is just natural stuff. Yeah, this is the reason that you're really told as you get older, it's so important to do weight-bearing exercise and strength training, because you're naturally going to be losing lean muscle mass. And so, you know, you can counteract that with exercise and with strength training. But this is kind of a natural process that happens. And particularly if you're not doing those things, your body composition changes. And so you tend to have more fat. But what can happen then, because muscle is weighing more, you may end up, you know, if you're retaining some of that, your BMI may actually go up a little bit, and yet that's protective. And so as you know, if you are over 60, 65, and this is really the key, if you're 18, you probably, you know, being overweight that age is probably not so good. But as you get older, in these older age categories, it seems to be a little bit protective, perhaps, or at least not as bad, you know, not something to worry about in that sense. Now, again, you don't want to be getting into the morbid obesity categories where it's a lot. But I think one of the messages here is that, you know, there's a lot of different things that we need to balance to be healthy. And as you get older, in particular, a lot of the doctors that I spoke to said, you know, what we really need to focus on is making sure that people are having those healthy habits. They're eating well, they're exercising, they're doing other good things for their health, you know, social interactions, things like this. And that, you know, being slightly overweight is not a list of priorities compared to those other things. And especially given how hard it is for people to lose weight. And, you know, what could be more harmful to someone's health than saying, you know, your body weight is bad, we need you to get down, and there's no way to really do that, and so we're just sort of setting you up for failure. I think that's not helpful. And so, yeah, this physician, Mara Gordon, she's at the Cooper Medical Center in New Jersey. She really specializes in working with larger body people. And she said, you know, we really focus on the health stuff. We don't need to talk about weight. We don't focus on it. We focus on what's your cholesterol, what's your blood pressure, you know, do you have good insulin sensitivity? Are you exercising? You know, what are you doing with your diet? And those are things that are actually actionable too. You know, people can try and lose weight and do things, but if they're doing these healthy habits, this should happen on its own. And so, you know, again, it's about getting away from that stigmatization of larger bodies.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with journalist and Scientific American contributor, Kristi Ashwanden. She's also the host of a Scientific American podcast called Uncertain, really interesting, and a co-host on a podcast, another podcast. Oh, shoot. What's it called, Kristi?
Emerging Form.
Emerging Form. And that's about the creativity process. And she's the author of a book that we interviewed her about when it came out in 2019 called Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. That was such a great book.
Oh,
and I've gotten a lot more massages since. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, you know, we also know that there are fat, skinny people. In other words, and that's probably not the term that is used, but there are very thin people who have fatty organs, who are, you know, who have high cholesterol, who have all of these criteria that typically would be associated with someone who's obese, but they're not healthy, even though they're thin. So that seems like a contradiction that also sort of supports what you have written about this month in Scientific American.
Absolutely. There are people who are, you know, their BMIs are low. They are not heavy. They may be skinny, but they have, you know, high proportion of body fat. They have a lot of fat around their organs. They are metabolically unhealthy. And I think, you know, this goes back to these other issues that really matter a lot more than weight. And that is, you know, what is going on with you metabolically? You know, are you exercising, being physically active, and all of this, you know, I think it really goes to this idea that there's not a one ideal. There's kind of a continuum, and there are different ways to get there. So you can be unhealthy and thin, and you can be, you know, larger or fatter and healthy. So it really depends on what's going on with your metabolic health, what's going on, you know, physically and mentally too.
Yeah. A moment ago, you talked about the hip to weight waist ratio, hip to waist ratio. Can you explain that a little bit more? Would this be the case where your waist is actually larger than your hips?
And that's... Yeah, or not necessarily, but it's a way of sort of measuring fat stored in the midsection seems to be metabolically less healthy than fat stored elsewhere. And
for the apple-shaped folks.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so, you know, having, you know, fat in the belly is, you know, tends to be more harmful to your health than fat in the hips or fat in the butt or in the legs, lower body, or even upper body, you know, arms or whatever. And this hip to waist ratio seems to be one way of getting at that. Again, it's a crude measure, but it's a way to sort of measure that. So if someone is having a larger belly area, that seems to be, you know, more harmful to health in many cases than storing the fat elsewhere.
And then I read in the article that there may be as little as 6% of people considered obese that are this metabolically healthy obese, on up to 60%. And the criteria are kind of maybe a little vague. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of ridiculous, right? It could be as few as 6% or upwards of 60%, depending on how it's measured. And in the story, I talk about a few studies that have looked at this. And what it really comes down to is how you define it. And so how stringently it is defined decides whether it's 6% or 60%. So on that higher scale of 60%, that's usually definitions that are saying, well, there maybe are five or six markers of metabolic health, and as long as half of them are okay, then we will call you healthy and all that. Whereas the very stringent ones are saying, if you have any of these things at all, then we're calling you unhealthy. So it really comes down to how it's defined. But the other thing I should just mention here is that there has been a push now. The American Medical Association actually put out a declaration some years ago stating that obesity is a disease. The WHO, World Health Organization, has similarly also defined obesity as a disease. And this has been kind of controversial. And I think some of this really comes down to, we don't have really good definitions of what a disease is. You know, it's really kind of a value judgment. And in fact, I spoke with very well-known researcher, David Allison at Indiana University, who said, you know, obesity is a disease because we declared it one, you know, we just decided. And it really came down to, the reason that this was done was to help with reimbursement and to make it easier for doctors to be able to treat obesity rather than the health problems that might be associated with it. So, it, you know, without obesity being declared a disease, you know, you might not be able to get some of these obesity drugs unless you were using it to treat diabetes, for instance, or, you know, other treatments and whatnot. And so it was really a move to try and open up access to treatments to obesity. And also, I think there was an idea that it might destigmatize it. We still have this cultural idea that people who are larger or who are fat, you know, they're lazy. It's something, you know, it's a personal failing. The science shows that that's usually not the case. It's really, you know, this is not something that is on someone's, you know, they've chosen to be this way. And we know that there's a continuum of body types that people are born with. And it's not easy for everyone to be thin. And so, you know, labeling this as a disease, it's just like no one says when you get cancer, oh, it's your fault and you're terrible, right? And so there is the need to do that. Now, I spoke with some people on the fat acceptance movement and they said, well, this hasn't really worked that way. And so now it's basically you're just being told that your body is a disease that's inherently diseased. And so we can debate whether that has had that intended effect. It has, you know, it has helped the industries it has helped companies and industries and you know, there's all sorts of money-making things around treating obesity and trying to help people lose weight, some of which can be helpful, some of which, you know, probably aren't helpful. But it's interesting. And so I think it's really up for the debate whether we really should be calling it a disease and whether that's been helpful or not. The messages are mixed here.
Yeah, I bet the fat industrial complex gets very twitchy when people don't want to solve themselves anymore.
That's right.
At least there's been a really great wave of the body positivity movement of accepting at all sizes. I personally notice it a lot if I'm shopping for something online. 10 years ago, you saw one type of body and it was straight up and down, skinny, white model. And now you see a lot of different shapes. And actually, I love how they're even showing things like stretch marks or, you know, things that aren't making us try to live up to this ridiculous ideal. And it just looks more like the traditional men and women. I would think that a study like this might really help support the body positivity movement. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's really just showing that, hey, you can't assume that someone who's larger is unhealthy and that they have all these health problems and we can't. But at the same time, I think it's also about helping people who, you know, it goes back to this idea that people that are larger, it's all their, you know, they've done something terrible and they're bad people. We need to get rid of that idea. And so even if someone, you know, is obese and has some of these problems, I think we really need to get away from this idea that, oh, it's all their own fault. They're not taking care of themselves. They're a bad person. And, you know, really developing some humanity towards them and not stigmatizing those bodies, which I think just has a sort of spiraling effect for people too. There's some pretty good data showing that shaming people really just does not help. And in fact, can lead to eating disorders and whatnot.
I just finished Johan Hari's book, The Magic Pill, about the GLP drugs, which was fantastic. And he brings up a lot of things about what got us to this point where such a high percentage of people are obese. And I just wondered how do you find that line between being happy with yourself and whatever size you are, and also being motivated to be the best version of yourself that you can be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure I have an answer. I mean, talking to doctors who work with patients, the ones that I talked to really came down on, you know, we need to help people do the things that they can do, the things that are within their control. And in some cases that may be, you know, you need to take some blood pressure medications and that's fine. But you also need to, you know, don't just take the drugs. You need to exercise. You need to, you know, take these steps that are helpful for you. And some of these are just things like spending time outside, you know, having a good social network. I mean, this is not all just about drugs and food, right? It goes beyond that. And so helping people to do that. And oftentimes these things have sort of a pile-on effect. You know, someone starts exercising regularly, they start feeling better about themselves, they start feeling better in their bodies, and that can really motivate them and help them take other healthy steps as well. But I think it's really about supporting people and looking at them as three-dimensional beings and not just a disease and not just, you know, the particular characteristic of their bodies.
It seems to me that we all ought to know about our metabolic health, and because that's the true determiner of health, yeah. Right? But really, that's, you know, that requires a trip to the doctor. Have you found in your research any other ways that people, you know, who may not be able to afford that, or their insurance doesn't cover it, or whatever it is, they don't have insurance, to find out about your metabolic health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I talked to some of the experts that I talked to for the story, said that this is one of the problems, is that we don't have an easy test. I mean, there are all kinds of tests that you can do. They cost money. They're usually not necessarily things that are going to be helpful. So you're basically just kind of going in and doing a bunch of tests that may or may not be called for. You know, if someone has an indication that something's going on, you may do some of these more specialized tests. Regular sort of blood panel will pick up on some of this stuff. But I think a lot of it are things that will show up at the doctor's office, right? Blood pressure. Yes, standard blood tests will often pick up insulin sensitivity. That's something that can be measured. But again, it's a little bit more that's a little bit more sophisticated test. And so you may need some sort of occasion to think that you need to look at that. So the answer is kind of like, no, there's not a good way to know about your metabolic health just with one easy test. Or, you know, this is one of the reasons I think that BMI is still so widely used, is because it is so simple. You know, it's height and weight. That can be done, you know, in a couple of minutes in the doctor's office. You can do it at home. And so it makes it easy, whereas these other things are much more sophisticated. And again, you know, there are many different definitions of metabolic health. And so which factors are you looking at? And, you know, some of the more complex ones you may only measure if you have other issues showing up that suggest, hey, you should look at those other ones as well. But we don't have a sort of one and done test for that.
Well, just in closing, it's worth noting in the article somewhere, and you mentioned that Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who we all know, and he's so muscular, but his BMI is like 34, which would by the standard say that he is what, obese?
Yeah. He would fall apparently into the obese category. And I think no one who looks at him would say that he is obese. So it really just speaks to the fact that BMI is a terrible marker.
Well, Kristi Aschwanden is our guest, and she has written a really interesting article in Scientific American that was released June 25th. It's called "People Who Are Fat and Healthy May Hold Keys to Understanding Obesity." So, Kristi, thank you so much for coming back on The Mountain Life.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
In our ongoing series on print publications in the outdoor and mountain town space, we welcome to the show the editor-in-chief of Ascent Magazine. It's a backcountry snow journal, and it chronicles how adventurous people climb, ski, ascend, and descend around the topography of the world. Paul Ulrich is a former Park City resident, and he joins us today from his home in the Sun Valley, Idaho area, to talk about Ascent, as well as a nascent project due out next year called Van Life Adventure Journal. Paul, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. So it must mean that the model that you have been operating under, an independent magazine, largely run independently by you, is a good model, because you're coming out with another next year.
That's correct. Ascent will be 9 years old this coming year. There was a 2-year hiatus due to the pandemic, which affected a lot of publications. And I've always been a small independent publisher focused on niche magazines and work by myself out of my home office. I have a designer who's been with me doing magazines for close to 20 years now. She still lives in Salt Lake. And, you know, with the advent of technology now, we're able to work out of our respective home offices, and contributions come in from people from all over, and it's all filtered through the computer and PDFs online and exchanges. And it's always been a fun way to put the publications together.
Makes for a good way to live where you want to live. That's for sure. Tell us a little bit about your background in Park City. I mean, we were just talking before we went on air about the Lodestar, which was one of my favorite publications way back when in Park City.
So I was running a ski store at Snowbird. I worked at Snowbird and kind of grew up in Little Cottonwood Canyon. And Jan Wilking, who was a one-time publisher of the Park Record and the Lodestar magazine, Jan had a bunch of business interests in Moab when the mountain biking boom was starting to hit the area back in the late 80s, early 90s. And Jan had a magazine called Bicycle Utah, which was a tourism publication designed to bring people to Park City, Moab, Southern Utah, Logan, all over the state, that was distributed by the Utah Travel Council. And he partnered with my father. Jan didn't have time to really run the magazine the way he wanted, so he partnered with my father to take over the magazine. My father had hired me to do advertising sales, and it was a great job. I got to travel around the state with my mountain bike and see all these new places to ride. And that was my start in the publishing business. I left Utah in 99 to take up a publishing opportunity for a bike magazine and also a ski magazine in California. Did that for several years. Moved back to Utah in 2004 to Park City, and had a magazine called the Utah Adventure Journal. And then shortly after that, started up Ascent, which is where I am today.
That gives us a little look before your schooling. Did you have any formal journalism experience or anything like that? Or was it the ad sales that drew you into the business, if you will?
Yeah, it was a combination of both. Yeah, I don't have any formal training. I don't have any formal education in editing or publishing. It was just kind of, a neat way to sell ads and meet people and hear their stories and collect their stories and tell people where to go. And it kind of went from there. The ad sales part was, of course, what drove the business. And, there would be opportunities, as I said, to meet unique people who had stories to tell on mountain biking, on skiing, on outdoor adventure, whatever. And that kind of led me to the path that I'm on. If you've looked at the current issue of Ascent, it might not be as quite as polished as some of the other national magazines out there. And I kind of like it that way. I think it lends some authenticity to it, that the articles may or be written by people who are skiers first and not necessarily writers, professional writers. It might be the guy who's working in the ski shop who has an English degree and he wants to try out writing an article. And some of the articles, they come in pretty rough, and I'll polish them up a little bit, but sometimes I'll leave that edge in there. So it gives an authenticity that, yeah, this guy's not a professional writer. This lady's not a professional writer. She's a skier first. And I've been called out on it before, actually. I've had some people say, you need a professional editor at your magazine. You don't know what you're doing. And I say, well, be that as it may, I kind of like it this way. And yeah, I'm not professionally trained, but I think it gives some authenticity to the stories and the tales of adventure behind them.
That authenticity is awesome. And for our listeners that haven't seen the magazine, I mean, it's a beautiful publication, and it really fits into this new style of like coffee table magazines, if you will. So the imagery is fantastic as well. So what was the big moment for you when you decided you were going to fill a niche in the backcountry kind of skiing and travel space with a magazine?
It was a pursuit that I've long enjoyed. As I said, I grew up skiing at Snowbird, and we used to do some ski touring there with some friends when I worked back in the ski store. And it was back when you either had a telemark ski setup or you had a very heavy alpine setup that was not necessarily conducive to ski touring. And as you know, over the years, the technology advanced and the technology changed, and it enabled more people to get into the backcountry and enjoy backcountry skiing as a way to get away from the resorts. And it was still a niche sort of market. But about 9 years ago, after being able to ski tour around the West, I thought that this could be a magazine that would fit that niche and find a market. And though it is small, it certainly has grown over the years for various reasons, if you wanted to discuss that. But at that time, it seemed like it would be a good fit, and it was embraced by the backcountry community for what it was, focused mostly on uphill travel, using that rather than just riding the lift and ducking under the rope, but people who are finding fantastic adventures under their own power.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Paul Ulrich. He is the editor-in-chief of Ascent magazine, and we're speaking to him. It's about the fourth in this series, this little series we've been doing on print publications in the West, in mountain towns. We have spoken to the editors, publishers of Adventure Journal, of Mountain Gazette, of High Country News. And now we're talking to you, Paul. And, you know, overall, it's been really interesting. We, as a radio station, you know, we've depended on people turning on that dial as they're driving around in their cars. But even what we do has changed, where our digital presence has been very important to sort of drive listenership via readership. I mean, Ascent has a very strong digital presence, but the actual print part of it is what makes it sort of pure, kind of like turning on your radio in your car and listening to KPCW. Can you explore that a little bit?
Oh, for sure, Lynn. There's definitely a segment of the outdoor world, the population, that cherishes having a print magazine and having the imagery that you can only find in print that plays out well on paper. Something that, as Jay mentioned, a coffee table publication that you can pick up and sit down on your couch and crack a beer open or sit on your patio and read about these adventures rather than staring at a phone or a pad or a computer, that it just doesn't translate as well as it does to print. That being said, you know, in this modern age, we all have to have somewhat of a presence on the internet with a website. And as a publisher, it's a way to drive people to the magazine, say, this is not just a digital publication, it's primarily a print. And there's a segment of people out there that will pay $30 a copy to have a hard copy of the magazine delivered to their mailbox that they can put on their coffee table. And it's become part of, I think, the backcountry community. Some people are very proud to subscribe to Ascent. It's something that they like to see that shows up in their mailbox. And not all of the content in the magazine is reflected online. And of course, that's for a purpose as well, because I want to sell some magazines. I want people to subscribe, and I want to get that into their hands. And that's kind of the model. Ascent used to be a free publication. It was a high quality free publication for the first 7 years. It was primarily driven by advertising revenue. The problem that I faced was I would drop it off in the ski stores, the coffee stores, the brew pubs as free copies. People would pick it up and say, wow, this is a nice magazine. This is really free. And they would disappear. And the ski shop would call me up and say, hey, we need more copies. We've gone through all of them. And I would say, I don't have any more. I don't have any more to give you. And people would say, well, how do we find it? And then, of course, I thought, well, why don't you subscribe and I'll send you a copy. And that worked as well. And then we had the pandemic hit, the COVID, and the challenges with that, the headwinds, of course, were that the ski resorts closed down. And as you guys know, everybody still wanted to get out and play. They wanted to go out and ski. So they took up backcountry skiing. They took up, they bought all the skis, they bought all the bikes, they bought all the camping gear. And all of a sudden you couldn't find a pair of skis on the ski rack in the store because they were they're all sold. The manufacturers then said, well, I need to ramp up production. I don't have any marketing. I don't need to spend any marketing dollars. I'm selling all of my product. I don't need to advertise. So that the advertising all dried up. And of course, with that, the magazine revenue dried up. So with the new model, as Jay said, after a 2-year hiatus, I said, okay, let's rethink this. Let's make this more of a higher quality, even yet coffee table type publication that has value that people will pay $30 a copy for, and limit the amount of advertising and make it more of a reader-driven subscription publication, which is the model that I've now embraced with the magazine.
Yeah, there is something about that as you're talking was making me think about that kind of scarcity model where you have to make something scarce to sort of drive that desire to hold it in your hands, to look forward to it in your mailbox every month. You know, how does it work out financially? How did you make that transition and even know for a second that it was going to work?
Well, that's the ongoing question, Lynn. It's still a challenge. The issue that Jay has in his hands that he received is the first new issue with that new model. And there is some excitement about it. But yeah, it's a challenge. There's many headwinds that the publisher faces nowadays. And I'm not sure if any of the other guests that you've spoken with on this topic have mentioned it, but paper prices are expensive. Ink is expensive. Press time is very expensive. Shipping a 134-page magazine through the U.S. mail is expensive, as well as getting your printer to deliver it to you, which, you know, I store in my barn behind my house here. That's my warehouse and my mail room. There are certain costs that obviously need to be met, and it's expensive to print a magazine. So it's always trying to find the balance where, yeah, how do I get more subscribers? How do I get this magazine into more people's hands? You know, using the website, social media channels to promote it. I'm certainly grateful for the opportunity, and hopefully this interview with you guys will fall on some ears of people who aren't familiar with the publication and they'll choose to subscribe. And, you know, using word of mouth to drive subscription increases. There still are a number of advertisers of manufacturing companies, outfitters, guides, services, that sort of thing, that see the need to attract that core consumer. And they're willing to still put their marketing budget into print advertising. As you guys know, there's many, many ways that companies can spend their marketing dollars. There's print, there's online. There's so many different ways that companies can spend their marketing dollars. And if they choose to spend it on a cent, I certainly want to see that they get results from that commitment.
So with your approach to, I mean, and some of the publications are calling, maybe not necessarily advertising anymore, you know, even your partnerships is, do you have a special approach to your advertising? I think, you know, some of these publications are taking the only full page approach and, you know, no fractionals and things of that nature to kind of keep the look, the aesthetic, you know, headed in the same direction as the vision for your publication. What are you doing with that? And are you doing anything special outside of really just showcasing their ad in the magazine? Are you doing anything further with the partnership?
Yeah, that's a great point, Jay. If you notice in the magazine, I'm only offering spreads and full pages. One of the benefits of being a small business, basically being a one-man show here, being publisher, editor, salesman, often delivery boy as well, is that I like to get creative. And yeah, it's not necessarily advertising as much as it is a partnership. Rather than saying, hey, buy a full page ad for X amount of dollars in my magazine and you know, good luck, hopefully you'll be a return customer, is that we need to develop partnerships and get creative, be it with print, combination of online, social media, events, sampling, that sort of thing, kind of a whole mixed bag of products that we can offer to pull into these partnerships to ensure that it's not just a one and done, that there is long-term revenue and a long-term partnership. And that's kind of been my practice from the get-go with publications. I do it all by myself, and it's something that needs to be built on and maintained and nurtured, and hopefully will be a long-lasting partnership with the people that support the main part of the business, which is the print magazine.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention your father. I met him many, many moons ago. So you had such a phenomenal mentor to learn from. And for those of our listeners that know Red Ulrich, I mean, he is a real class act, and developing relationships was, I think, the cornerstone of his being. I mean, he would just call out of nowhere, "How you been? Well, what's going on?" I was like, "You're not selling me anything?" It was phenomenal. So if that's your approach, I mean, the magazine for you, the sky's the limit. Tell us a little bit about the magazine. I mean, the subscribers, like, meaning what is the ideal subscriber? I want the listeners to know, hey, you're not picking this thing up and seeing a bunch of gear review kind of short story format. Like, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm not particularly keen on doing gear reviews. At some point, they are a necessity to satisfy that package that some of the advertisers want to see, but usually I relegate those to online status. The print magazine, as you've seen, is, I'd rather use the space to tell stories. I've been fortunate enough with this magazine that it's taken me all over the world. And one of the things that's always been the eye opener on some of these travels to far flung places is that it's more than just skiing. It's meeting, it's being part of these cultures that have skiing as part of their cultures. As you guys probably know, we have a very strong ski market in the United States. And that kind of, I think, drives the market around the world. But it still has somewhat of a different feel than places such as Europe, where you ski from village to village, and it's embedded in their culture and has been for forever, for years. There are some neat stories that I think are targeted, and I love to share with people who are seeking new places to adventure to. Antarctica, Georgia, Morocco, some of these places that I've been able to ski. It's really eye-opening, and it is more than the skiing. It's about the people that you meet from all over the world who are seeking these different adventures. And that's kind of the driving, motivating factor. In the current issue, if you've had a chance to read it, I don't always meet the writers. They kind of find me and say, "Hey, I've got this great story I want to tell. Would you be willing to put it in your magazine?" And the answer is always, "Yes, I would." Can you give me some pictures to accompany it as well? Because that's kind of the main thing to add to the visual quality of it. But there's an article in the current issue that was submitted to me blindly by this fellow who was a former Army medic, and he and his buddies got into backcountry skiing a couple of years ago, and they decided to do a ski tour in Norway that traversed over the high plateau, retracing the route of Norwegian commandos that blew up a Nazi nuclear facility in Norway back in World War II. These commandos that went through just these excruciating conditions in Norway, traversing and living in the woods and freezing temperatures, and they snuck into the plant and they blew it up. And him and his army buddies decided to retrace the route. Of course, it's a little bit more comfortable for them now with the modern amenities, but it's an amazing story with the history that they did this. And I said, this is what I'm looking for. This is the kind of spirit of adventure that I think is what appeals to the readership. And just, finding new adventures like that and reading these unique stories, I think are what's what I hope drives the publication.
We're speaking with Paul Ulrich of Ascent Magazine. Paul, this must be working out really well for you, because you are about to launch another publication, and it sounds like Van Life Adventure Journal is just how it is titled.
van life. This has been a huge, you know, probably a lot since COVID or during COVID, people started getting in vans and living and traveling and adventuring. And I've seen quite a few blogs on the van life and, you know, YouTube channels and things like that. Tell us a little bit about this forthcoming project.
Well, for sure, Lynn. As you mentioned, and as we discussed earlier in the interview, the pandemic kind of changed our outdoor adventure lives and what we were seeking and pursuing. We built a van here as kind of our pandemic escape pod, as ways to get around and travel to satisfy that traveling Jones that we all have and seek of our adventures. And the pandemic obviously saw a big rise in the van life. And yeah, we do more than ski. We enjoy mountain biking. We enjoy climbing. We enjoy hiking. We enjoy traveling around. And the van has been a great vehicle to accomplish this nowadays. It's, you know, you can drive and park right at the mountain biking trailhead or the crag or wherever and have your whole little home on wheels right there. Of course, being in magazine business for 25 years, the bell went off and said, why not do something print for this? This is, I think, a market that there's a readership for, and there's been several companies that have shown interest in it as well. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there doing unique adventures, and it kind of fits the bill with my publishing theory. So we'll give it a go. I think we'll have the first copy out, and it'll be a same type of quality as Ascent, like Jay said, a coffee table publication. And we're looking to release the first issue next spring.
That's great. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
You know, since you were talking about, you know, like giving the example of the veteran who retraced the steps in Norway of that event that went down in World War II, you must be relying on photographs that they are taking, which may or may not be high quality photographs, but you've got this high quality print publication. How do you square the two?
Yeah, that's correct. That's there's usually a lot of bad photos, and usually in those bad photos, you can find a gem or two. The technology has increased nowadays, of course, where the photos that a person can take on their phone are good enough. Or you don't need to carry around a big SLR camera with a variety of lenses. You can use a point and shoot that has enough quality in the imagery that it'll work. You know, of course, there are a number of professional photographers that are still out there, and they're cranking out the content, and you'll recognize some of the names in the publication. And I'm glad to have those photos in there as well. But hopefully you'll take a look at the magazine and see that we're making it work with what we've got.
Excellent. Well, Paul Ulrich, it's been great speaking with you this morning. Best of luck with Van Life Adventure Journal and continued success with Ascent.
Don, I just wanted to say good luck with everything. And I love that you're keeping the print world alive. And Mike Rogge has that famous saying, it's not famous to him, I don't believe, but print isn't dead. So I know we have a bunch of eager backcountry enthusiasts here in town, and this magazine is fantastic. So go grab one.
Thank you very much, Jay. Thank you, Lynn, for the opportunity. It's great to see you and chat with you guys as well.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can hear this full episode wherever you get your podcasts, on the KPCW app, or by visiting the Shows tab at kpcw.org. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.